Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, www.richardphotolab.com, DR5, www.dr5.com, Iger Studios, check them out, igerstudios.com, and of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the community for analog photography, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to have with us Chris Buck. Chris is a editorial and celebrity photographer doing beautiful work, unbelievable portraiture, and just really cool stuff, and of course, using film. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm very good. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program today and all this beautiful photography you're doing and all this cool stuff you're up to.
Well, I'm glad you see it that way.
It is cool. So, Chris, let's talk about yourself. You're a Canadian now in New York City doing lots of editorial, lots of celebrity photography. But give us a little background on how you got into photography. Was this something that you got into when you were a kid? How'd that all work out?
Well, actually, I do shoot a lot of advertising as well. In fact, I'm shooting kind of more advertising right now than I am editorial for the obvious reasons. Well, two reasons. One is that, of course, editorial isn't as strong as it has been the last few years, but also because I've just been getting myself into the advertising thing more, and it's been really a treat. But to answer your question, I am from Toronto. In fact, my father worked for Kodak. And Kodak, of course, is primarily based in Rochester, but they had Kodak Canada, which existed all through my childhood and I guess before I was born. It closed, I think, sometime in the early 90s, the Canadian one. But my father worked there until the late 80s, probably starting in the early 60s. All through my childhood, my father worked at Kodak, and I think that's probably one of the main reasons I'm a photographer. I was always good at art, and that was sort of my thing at school. It was the only thing I was really good at. But because my father worked at Kodak, once I got more serious about picking a profession, I knew I'd work in the arts and certainly the popular arts. Photography was something I took to quite naturally. Not to say I was really good, but I could see the difference that even once I was shooting, results were promising right away. So I took to it and worked hard at making it something I could possibly be great at. The funny thing is my father didn't really take a lot of pictures, but just working at Kodak and taking pride in his work was something that I was very aware of. And of course, I admired my father, as most boys do. And I ended up working there for summers when I was in college, and that gave me, of course, a closer look at it. And I was studying photography at the time, so initially I was just working the kind of grunt jobs. In fact, at one point, my father was the head of a building, the top manager of it, and I was the lowest person in the building, who was the summer student who cleaned the toilets. Obviously, I was treated well. The other employees weren't idiots. They knew that my father was the boss. And my father said, it's good for you to be working the most sort of ordinary position to know what it's like, and you will hopefully learn to be respectful to people who have very straightforward jobs like this, because you will be one of them. And he was really right. I think I'm probably more respectful to ordinary working people when I'm out in the world than I might have been if I hadn't done that kind of job.
I think you're right. I think if people have done what they see other people do and other jobs that aren't as meaningful as maybe what they're currently doing, they do have a respect for that guy that's there working hard and doing this deal, where if you didn't have that experience, you would just look at it and go, oh.
Well, I don't think I'd look down at people so much, but not that I put myself in their shoes exactly, but I've kind of been there at least temporarily, and it gives you an experience of it. It makes you appreciate where you're at, but also have respect for people and that they work very hard, and I guess you just know how hard that work can be.
Sure. Did you do any photography through high school, the typical yearbook deal?
I worked for the yearbook and the school paper. Definitely was a great learning experience. I mean, in a way, because of the professional aspect of working for the yearbook, I actually photographed our principal at one point, and I was sent in to photograph him, and I was thinking I was going to do like a sit-down portrait with him, and he was like, all right, boy, get to shooting. Why aren't you taking any pictures? That was a good lesson for me on, well, one, what expectations the subject might have, but two, how to learn how to deal with people who have more authority than me, more prestige than me, and I had to learn how to control the session. And he was a nice guy, but he clearly was a busy man and had expectations. And he, in a nice way, kind of bullied me into doing what he wanted. And it was a good lesson for me to learn how to manage those situations. And I was just in high school, and that was great. When I was in college, I ended up working for a music paper that kind of grew out of my college. That was even better because I was paid a pittance and went out and did assignments and I had professional obligations. And it was really with no pressure because no one really looked at this thing, so it didn't really matter. So my first few years of real shooting was at those kind of assignments, and that was invaluable. One of the great things about that, actually, was that everyone who worked there did it for the love of it. And starting off that way was a great way to frame my viewpoint going forward. That, of course, I've taken many jobs because I just need to work or I need to make money. The initial publication is called Nerve. It's a monthly music paper in Toronto. And it still frames what assignments I take or don't or how I go into assignments. Just that kind of professionalism I brought to that is still the way I kind of shoot now.
Definitely a cool background to be able to bring you up to where you're at today. So what brought you from Toronto to New York City?
Well, funny enough, when I finished college, I took a little vacation with a friend, and we basically decided to go to places we could stay for free, as college students will. And so we came to New York and also went to San Francisco, the two places we could crash on people's couches, as it were. So when I came to New York, I'd actually made a portfolio in my final term at college, so I brought it with me, just on a whim. I took it around to some of the magazines I liked and respected in New York. I went to Spin Magazine, Rolling Stone, Vanity Fair, Esquire, people like this, all the big magazines. And they are all very nice and very welcoming. What ended up happening was people would send me to smaller magazines who they thought I could get more initial work from. People were very, very nice and very welcoming. Literally, I'd be in someone's office and they'd say, oh, hold on a second. They'd pick up the phone and they'd call and make an appointment for me somewhere else. That was really very exciting, as you might imagine. My friend I was traveling with considered a total drag because he didn't care. He wasn't a photographer. He wanted to do fun things. But I was off doing meetings. Then I went back to Toronto. Now, I hadn't even gone around Toronto yet to show my portfolio because I literally just finished it. So I went to go show it around Toronto. I called the first one, and they said, well, send us some of your tear sheets. And I said, well, I'm just out of school. I don't really have any tear sheets. I'd shot for that Nerve paper, but the tear sheets were kind of pathetic. So I knew I had really nothing to show of any professional caliber. They said, okay, well, when you have some tear sheets, send them over. And I'm like, you won't look at portfolios? No, we don't look at portfolios. I'm thinking Vanity Fair and Esquire will look at my portfolio, but not Toronto Life magazine. This is amazing. That was kind of the beginnings of my realizing that New York, in some ways, maybe even the U.S. in general, but certainly New York was unique in terms of its attitude towards outsiders and just young people. I kind of started making my plans at that point to move to New York, and I moved, I guess, 3 years after that. It might seem a long time, but I need to kind of build my portfolio to a certain professional caliber to really get work and feel confident that I could get the work. And I saved a little bit of money. I lived at home with my parents, which, looking back and looking at young people today, I think was one of the keys to my success as well, that the fact that I didn't have to pay substantial New York rents right away out of college, got to sort of save a little money and get a little bit of a nest egg, and then bring that to New York. And I burned through that in the first year, but it gave me some kind of footing in New York without having to be a photo assistant or get other kinds of jobs. I really came to New York and only worked as a photographer. And I think that was really crucial for me, psychologically as well as financial footing.
Well, definitely, and I think being able to come to New York City and actually work as a street photographer and not an assistant or this deal or that deal as you're ramping up is a big deal.
It really was. I mean, obviously my jobs I did were very modest, but one of my professors, his name is Dave Heath, he had lived in New York and worked in New York at one time, and he really gave me great advice. He said, move to New York sooner rather than later, and he said, don't be a photo assistant. He said, you're already being published. It's a step backwards for you to be an assistant. And I think he recognized the importance for me psychologically to see myself as a photographer. And even though on a financial level I was not making a living, but he understood that it was important for me to see myself as a shooting photographer. The fact that I wasn't making much money from it wasn't really that important in the long run. And I think he was really right.
Do you find that since you didn't work an assistant that you were able to keep your own style and look uniquely yourself? Because you weren't working under somebody else that was giving you a heavy influence.
I do think that is an element. I think that there's an aspect of, I see my assistants, and I see they work for a variety of people, and then they break out on their own. And there is an aspect of, you do need to shoot and light on your own to really learn it. And understandably, assistants don't want to shoot like the people they work for. They want to have their own style, their own lighting, their own look. So assistants kind of break out, and their lighting will be kind of awkward initially, and then they'll figure it out. Well, I think that there's an aspect where they just kind of overtly kind of shake off the influence of the people they worked with. But I think more than the aspect of trying to figure out their style, I think it's more a question of financial things. You're 32 and you've been assisting for 6 years, 7 years. To go from that to being a shooter is much more difficult than doing it at, say, 25, when you're living much less comfortably when you're 25. When you're 32, you've got a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and you're kind of settled in, and you're enjoying life, and you're going away for weekends and stuff. You don't do that stuff when you're 25, and so you don't really care if you make much money. And I think having to transition to shooting when you are kind of used to living comfortably can be very, very difficult to go from making a very good income 1 year as an assistant to making negative amounts of money the next year as a full-time photographer because you're spending a lot of money on shoots and making almost no money as a shooter. It's kind of daunting because when you're in your early 30s, you care as much about making a living as you care about making interesting work. So I think being a shooter early on without the stakes being high is a huge advantage, yes.
What do you think about this whole thing about people building their look? I mean, there's only so many ways to light stuff and there's only so many things you can do. So how do you find that you are able to pull out your distinctive look compared to what other people are doing and have done and will do? I mean, we're all riding with light, but how do you find that people can sort of stand out where there's so many people doing photography now and there's so much stuff going on? There's only so many ways you can do things. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I do think that you see my work and you see a distinctive style, but I guess I have some kind of style when it comes to lighting, but really it's not like anyone's going to admire me for my lighting. They might like my overall feel of my pictures. They might say they don't dislike what I do with light, but it's not like anyone's going to be blogging about my great lighting. But that, of course, at this point in my career is a choice. As much as I respect people who do amazing things with constructed lighting, it's not really where my interests lie. So in some ways, that is a part of my style. Clearly, I make choices. I know how to light, and I make choices about my lighting in terms of how they're going to affect the pictures or what feel I want to have come across to the viewer. And I always admired people who did their lighting in a way that was not making the lighting the point. I was influenced by people like Irving Penn and Arnold Newman. Obviously, their pictures, you wouldn't think to do bad lighting, but you don't look at Penn and think, hey, awesome lighting. You think, what an interesting moment or whatever, or what an odd way that he thinks. So that was certainly a big influence on me. Also, I mean, certainly in terms of a visual style, I certainly was very aware of that early on, and it was a conundrum for me. I'd see people in college who had these really distinct visual approaches, and I was always very envious. It certainly was not an area I excelled at early on. What I've kind of learned in retrospect is that I think that knowing what subject matter interests you, what your subject matter is, I think matters more to a young photographer in the long run than a lighting style or a visual approach. I think that what ends up happening is if you are a serious photographer, your style is going to shift and change, and it will essentially find you. I think when you go out looking for a style as a young photographer, you're going to find yourself grappling at things and maybe finding something that's interesting and fun, but ultimately superficial.
Let's chat about your portraiture. Did you always want to shoot people? Was that something that you had a keen interest in, was documenting and being able to bring out different aspects and looks of people? Or do you have a keen interest in other types of photography, landscape, so forth? Or is really your main gig is you digging portraiture?
Well, I really kind of attached myself to photography as a medium because of my interest in celebrity and pop culture. So when I was in high school and we would do drawings and things like this, I would draw Jim Morrison or Marlon Brando, John Lydon, people like that. That's what I was interested in. Or sometimes old movie stars like Joan Crawford. So I was interested in celebrity. So when I started shooting seriously, I wanted to shoot bands and actors and directors. And as I got more older and serious, politicians and writers and cultural people. And so that was initially what I really wanted to shoot, and that's what I really drove towards. My initial thing was shooting musicians, and then I very quickly started shooting businessmen, politicians, writers, and people like that. So I've got an older website, which is called Vintage Chris Buck. If you go and look, even the earliest collections there have people from different vocations and mediums, so that's kind of fun. But as my career developed, clients would approach me to shoot different kinds of people, and then even non-people pictures. At first, I found it kind of puzzling. You know, when I started shooting more what I call real people, I would kind of shoot them as if they were celebrities in a way. But I found that my take on them and the way I approached them shifted over time and became something else that was certainly colored with my style, but I began to shoot real people in a way distinctly different to the way I shot celebrities. And that's obviously an ongoing thing, and it shifts as time changes and I do more shooting, I approach them differently. But also shooting things that didn't have people in them, that became kind of interesting. I mean, one of the first things I did was a series for Outside Magazine about phobias. And when I shot them, I was shooting little dolls, but I kind of shot the dolls as if they were people. So it became this weird thing where I'd kind of transfer my portrait viewpoint to the object. And now I'm actually doing a series where people are hidden in the picture, so you don't really see people in the picture at all. But strangely, it's still a portrait because they're actually in there. It's sort of a weird thing. But as you know, as a photographer, even though you enter through one thing, your vocabulary becomes more full as you shoot longer, and you can do different things. And when I'm offered assignments to do travel stories or landscapes or whatever might come up, I will take it gladly because it's an interesting challenge for me to grow and to see, well, can I do a picture without a person in it and it still be interesting? And that becomes a fun challenge.
Now, how was the influence when your high school principal said, boy, get after it, and the way that influenced you on how it was when you're working with some of these celebrity people? Because you shot definitely some high-end clientele, so does it ever get to the point to where you're starstruck, to where you're like, wow, I'm taking this guy's photo or her or whatever?
Yes, I mean, there's essentially two questions there. I think that one learns how to work a situation to create the environment they want in a portrait sitting or any kind of photo shoot. And for lack of a better word, I do so passively. I choose the music that might be played. I choose how much I might talk to the subject or even the client. I kind of make little choices along the way that influence how the shoot might roll out. Even the crew I hire. Some people create a party atmosphere on set. My shoots are a little more laid back. I consider it kind of a working atmosphere. And in some way, I'm trying to communicate to my subject, whether it's a celebrity or not, that we're here to make pictures. We might have a good time, but we're essentially here to make some interesting pictures today. And I do like to communicate to my subjects, my clients, that to some extent, this is my set and I'm setting the tone for it. And most of the time, it goes very smoothly. In a way, early on, unconsciously, I would do things and say things to subjects that might provoke them or might try to make them comfortable or whatever, and I didn't mean to do so overtly. But as I've gotten older and more aware of the process, I can kind of see myself doing things that might make the subject more comfortable or even less comfortable to let them know I'm in charge. And then the other question about being starstruck, I am starstruck sometimes. I mean, in a way, I guess there are times I shoot people who I'm generally a fan of and really admire. And those times I really work hard to try to put that aside and not be influenced by it. I mean, influenced in the sense that I work hard to make good pictures or come up with some good ideas beforehand, but I really try to think about delivering quality work to my client and ultimately getting pictures that I'm happy with and feel like justify the session happening at all. And I remember one time someone asked me about shooting William Shatner and saying, like, wow, that must have been really scary. Like, he's an intense guy and he's kind of unpredictable and he's a great star. And I said, yeah, I was afraid of William Shatner, but I was more afraid of Esquire magazine. In a way, that's kind of how it goes. I'm more concerned with not getting good pictures. I'm afraid of getting bad pictures more than I'm afraid of any subject in their intimidation.
Who's been your, I guess, number one portrait celebrity person that you've worked with? Who have you had the best connection with, and then also how that worked into what you were working when you shot? The point would be, who's your favorite person to shoot?
Well, there's lots of people who've been great. I mean, William Shatner, actually, I called him my muse. I mean, he's awesome. Totally difficult and totally wonderful. A very complex man, but it's one of the reasons why I find him interesting. I think he's really one of the greats out there. Andy Dick was one of my favorite people to shoot, and we actually became friends after the shoot as well. Andy was at one of his lowest points, and he was happy to celebrate for the photographs, which is usually not what happens. So he got some really dark, crazy photos of him, and it was really a blast. I mean, he gave me his all, and it was really a delight. He knew my work when I came into the shoot, and that really helped too. And he's a really nice guy, really, really sweet. You know, there's so many people I've enjoyed working with, and some of my shoots that have been really among my most successful. I didn't have a particularly strong bond with Billy Bob Thornton. I got some of my best shots ever and multiple shots from one session, and yet we barely spoke. But he was just a very giving subject and very professional. In a way, he brought that thing I said I like. He brought a good work attitude. He was there to work hard and deliver good work. And that worked out great. He was very professional, but not particularly friendly or engaged on a personal level. But professionally, he was there 100%, and for that reason, I got great work. James Caan was one of my favorite people to meet. I got a great picture out of him, but also I just found him to be just a character beyond what I imagined. I mean, I'm a fan of his work. I know a lot of his films, but in person, he was just hilarious and just so interesting to talk to. It was just amazing.
So as an example of the shoot you did for Esquire with William Shatner, and there's two mock police guys basically arresting him and handcuffing him, was this something that you came up with, like, this would be cool for the shoot? How does that work when you're setting up these shots? Is it something you have in your mind? You're like, okay, well, let's see what William would look like when he's getting busted by the LAPD. They're dragging him off. Or is this something sort of comes together between yourself and the art director that's there? How's that sort of come about?
Well, there's a combination of elements that come together to make any shoot work well and come together. Typically, I will be given an assignment, and I'll take some time to think about what I might want to do with them. And then I'll have to present those ideas to the magazine and possibly to the subject. in the case of Shatner, sat down and thought of a number of ideas, but I also went through a list of older ideas of things I'd written down in the past. Maybe I thought about it for another shoot and didn't use it. In fact, the idea of being arrested came from a shoot I did with The Strokes. It was for a British magazine, and I knew they'd love to get some kind of New York element in there. The Brits love that stuff. So I thought, wouldn't it be fun if I shot the band in the studio? How can I bring New York into the studio? I've got the guys lined up, but I've got some cops coming in on the edge of the frame, and they're coming in to arrest them. Because they're kind of bad boys, that'd be kind of funny that the guy at the end is being arrested, or they're just kind of coming in arresting them. Well, that turned out to be impractical for that shoot, and we did something else. But I wrote that idea down, and when I was thinking of Shatner, I saw that idea and thought, well, that'd be kind of odd, Shatner being arrested. That could be kind of interesting. I kind of liked that Shatner had his original persona as kind of a heroic character, Captain Kirk and all that. And then later on, he was kind of made fun of for his attempts at being creative and artistic, his record albums and all that. And he's kind of teased for that, but he kind of turned around and made it his own shtick later on. And then he kind of made it his own, which I thought was very clever of him, and I really admired how he had done that. And had to set a whole second and third career based on this kind of being a kind of has-been and kind of a joke, but making the joke his own thing. But I thought, well, let's take it further and make it serious again, but make it darker. And so I liked the ambiguity of him being arrested, and it's not really clear what he's being arrested for or anything like this. And I liked the idea of being arrested on set, and you can see I shot him on a soundstage. So it's like the idea of twisting it back again, but in a way that's sort of ambiguous, and I thought he'd be really into it. But what happened was, we talked on the phone, I talked about a number of ideas with him. He agreed to a couple different ideas, and he agreed to this one, but when we went to go do it, we were in L.A., and I had these guys, actually one of the guys I got through the photo editor at the magazine, another guy I got, he was actually a photo editor at another magazine that was based in Los Angeles, but he was a friend, and he agreed to do it, and I thought he had the right look. So both of the guys came out, we rented these LAPD costumes. So I was like, all right, I want to give direction to all three of you at once. So when you all come over to where Mr. Shatner is getting his makeup done. So the three of them are standing there. I'm starting to describe what I'm looking for. And Shatner interrupts me and he says, explain to me again. What does this shot mean? I don't really get it. I'm being arrested. What for? What's the underlying meaning of this? And I'm thinking, most of the time I know what the shots mean. But occasionally I come up with ideas that I just think they're interesting and I don't really know yet what they mean. So this is one of those shots. And I'm like, oh boy, what am I going to say here? So I start talking, and I kind of talk around it a bit. And he's like, I don't know what you're getting at. And he's like, I don't like this shot. I don't like where it's going. I'm not comfortable with it. What do you say?
Yeah, what do you say?
I said, all right, guys, I'll see you on set in 10 minutes. And I walked away. And I kind of answered his question, but kind of didn't.
Cool.
And I figured, you know what? We talked on the phone beforehand. He called me from his car 2 weeks before the shoot, and he approved his idea, and he knew he did. And so when I walked away and walked on set, I think he recognized I have a professional obligation to do this because I agreed beforehand. And the shot was no different on set than what I described to him.
Did you get any feedback from him after the fact?
Well, here's what happened. We went to go shooting, and basically it's kind of a setup shot. It kind of looks set up, but kind of not. I like that it's kind of in between even in that way. And as we're shooting, at a certain point I said, Mr. Shatner, how are you doing? And he said, I don't get this still. I'm very uncomfortable. This is really awkward. And I was like, that's a perfect expression. Hold that. And I kept shooting. So then we went on to the next shot. And he was uncomfortable. But as we got shooting, he kind of relaxed and we chatted a bit. I talked to him a little bit. I'd actually met him as a fan 20 years before in Toronto. He'd been filming a movie. I met him and got his autograph. I told him that, and we talked about other things. And I said to him, don't worry, this shot is not going to be posting it everywhere on blogs and stuff. It's going to be an Esquire. He looked at me, and he said, it better be, because if it shows up anywhere else, I will sue you. He wasn't smiling, he wasn't kidding, nothing. And I'm, oh boy, I'm in trouble. Because, of course, if I find a picture I like, I'm going to want to use it. Maybe if I want to do a monograph of my own work, or on my website, or anywhere else. The magazine, I didn't tell them this, of course, but I really steered them towards this picture, because if they didn't use it, I could never use it anywhere, because if they used it, I could use it as a tear sheet. He couldn't sue me for that, because it was an Esquire. Well, they did use it, thankfully, and what happened was, I got called to shoot him again for a different magazine. And I took the assignment largely because I wanted to go to him and have him sign a piece of paper, just like I drew it myself in kind of legalese language, but just covering, basically, that if I do a book, that this picture can be in the book. The shoot went well. At the end of the shoot, I asked him to sign this thing, and he signed it, thankfully. And that's why I'm able to use it. But I love this picture. I think it's pretty delightful.
Oh, it's very cool. Very, very cool. So let's chat about digital and analog. I know that you love to shoot film still. You're also shooting digital. Let's chat about one over the other and why digital and why film.
Sure. Well, to me, there's three things about digital that make it attractive. One is the workflow. The workflow is so quick and easy, and you can see if you're getting it or not. I mean, film just seems so bizarrely mysterious now. Having shot film for over 20 years, it's sort of funny how easily I'm swayed by the kind of proof aspect of digital. So there's that aspect of the workflow. The quick turnaround, clients can see on set. The second thing is, certainly for advertising, I want my client to see the work as I'm shooting it. It's crucial for me that they feel confident about what we're doing and that we're going the right direction. If they're feeling good, that we can move on to the next shot. The thing about film, there's a number of things, is one, that when you're shooting a celebrity and you're shooting film, they can't look over your shoulder and try to edit your work, either the subject or the publicist, and the magazine even, too. But really, I'm more worried about the publicist and the celebrity. I've actually heard horror stories of celebrities basically sitting in front of the laptop and editing people's pictures and saying, this is what you'll hand in. So I don't want that to happen. It hasn't happened to me yet. I've done a few shoots with digital because of the quick turnaround. But more importantly is the archival aspect. When I shoot film, I know that I have a negative that is going to look great. And with the film, I can have the best of both worlds. I can scan my negative or transparency and then work from that and do whatever digital work I want. Do cleanup, composite work, whatever. And then spit out a beautiful C print or a match print or whatever the client needs. Whereas with digital, whatever the quality is now that I shoot, that's what I'm going to have to work with in 10 years, 20 years, 40 years, whatever. So if you go to work on a picture you took 5 years ago digitally, and you go to work on it now with Photoshop, you can do lots with it, but it can only still be as good as, on some level, what you shot 5 years ago.
Oh, exactly.
And not just the pixel size, but also the way that it renders tones and things like that. And that leads to another thing about film that I love. The third thing is, there's certain things it renders better than digital, like skin tones. Even the way that it renders the way tones flow into each other in non-skin tones, there's more in there to work with. And if you scan it or whatever, you just have more to play with. And also the digital technology of scanning and retouching is going to improve, of course, exponentially as time goes on. And you'll be able to do more with those negatives and transparencies, do more of them in 10 years than you can do with them now. So your original master will always be a wonderful thing you can go back to. And you can do so much more with it later on. So I think those are the really great things about it. But the workflow stuff of digital is a tempting mistress. That's what it's like, is my wife is film and digital is a mistress.
Do you find that, especially when you're working with people in the entertainment industry, that they have more of a respect for film? And since they're used to shooting motion pictures on film, that they like film better just because it's film?
Interestingly, people do comment. I shot J.J. Abrams recently, and we shot film, and he made a point of saying that he really liked that. He was really into that. Strangely, some publicists actually are starting to say that they prefer film because they know that it looks better on their subject, even with retouching and all that, that they know that it's actually more flattering.
Well, I mean, look at a piece of film. It catches every color of photon light that comes through. Digital has a bear pattern, and it's got more green. And, I mean, yes, the Phobion chip was very cool emulation of film, but very limited in what you can do with it now. And I just think that with film, like you said, you can pick up an old camera. You can pick up an oatmeal box and make a photo.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. What do you like to shoot emulsion-wise? Do you like doing the portrait stuff on chrome, colored neg? What do you like?
Well, I really miss shooting chrome, but the fact is my editorial clients haven't seen it in so long. They literally call me and say, what is this?
They don't remember?
They're like, it's a negative, but it looks like a print. And like, really? You don't know what this is? So they don't know. They're like, what do I do with this? I'm like, will you send it to the printer? So that's a problem. I think for personal projects, I could do it. I think it's just too much for the tour, which is really a shame, because it's less expensive to deal with. And also, when you scan it, you're going positive to positive. When I deal with scans from negatives, I end up talking to the lab, doing 3 or 4 go-arounds, correcting color and stuff. If they scan transparency, I do 2 go-arounds. And the first one's really just for density, and then the color's usually spot on, because it's positive to positive.
Well, they have an example, too. They have one in their hand. They can look at a light table and go, yep, that's that color red. This is cool.
Well, that's it. The thing is, the photo assistants, I'm lucky to find ones who know how to load film. I'll say to them, no, we're shooting transparency. This is what we shoot is what we get. What do you mean? You have to shoot the color that the lights are? I'm like, yes, you do. You have to put gels in front of our lights and then a gel in front of the camera. And they're, wow, you're putting a filter in front of the camera? I'm like, yes, that's what you do.
Well, you can look at your work and tell. A lot of the images, even on the website, you can tell between analog and digital.
It's true. I mean, I don't know. I'd be curious to see if you could tell the difference between what was analog and digital, just among the straight images.
Plus, it depends on who is doing what and what the retouching is and the stuff that's been applied to the images. But really, in theory, you shouldn't be able to tell.
I think in magazines you can't tell, or at least you can't tell depending on the style of photographer. Because I was talking with some photographers recently, and they were saying, well, you can't tell. I'm like, you can't tell in a magazine, but you can tell in an exhibition. If you have a gallery show, you can tell the difference between digital and film.
Oh, yeah.
Like, one of the things you said originally is that photographers will shoot personal projects with film, and I think that's one of the reasons why, is that if you're shooting for something that might be a gallery show in 2 years or whatever, you want to be on film preferably, and because you know it's just going to print up better.
Right, and people say, oh, well, you get this big megapixel with digital, and you have these big digital medium format bags, and you have all this stuff. But as you well know, you can shoot medium format film. You are in a Mamiya, right?
Yep.
And you drum scan that stuff. There's a lot more information there than there is in digital.
I think that the amount of pixels, I think, is misleading. That's not my issue with digital. I think the amount of information I'm fine with. It's more how it renders the information.
The tonality.
Each other, or even how depth of field renders. I don't like the digital renders depth of field, like, much less pronounced. And I shot an ad job recently, and one of my instructions to the retoucher was, make the background look more out of focus. Because it looked too in focus.
Right, exactly. You like to shoot your portraits with a very shallow depth of field?
If I shoot available light, I'll tend to shoot at 4.5 or something like that, and that's medium format. Right. If I'm shooting strobe, I tend to shoot more like around f11, 11.5, only because if I'm shooting natural light and I'm trying to get more shutter speed, I might be shooting a 30th of a second or even a quarter of a second or something like that. Whereas if I'm shooting strobe, I kind of don't want to have to obsess over my focus, so I'll shoot f11.5, and if I focus a tiny bit off, it'll be indecipherable. So that's the only reason I do that.
And I know you're shooting, what, Canon for your digital work, correct?
I shoot Canon. Editorial, I'll do 35 with the Mark III, and then for advertising, I'll do the P30.
And, of course, you're shooting an RZ for your film work?
Yeah, I shoot the RZ for the editorial film. And I really miss shooting the Hasselblad, to be honest. But it seemed like about, I don't know, 10 years ago, magazines no longer would lay out to a square. So I kind of had to stop shooting it. It's kind of sad. I might shoot some personal projects with it coming up in the future. I've got a couple of Hasselblads. I'm kind of tempted to sell them, only except that I kind of think I might shoot a personal project with it.
They are sort of chunky and whatever, but like you said, there's something to do with the Blad. And even with your RZ, the way you interact with the subject, instead of hiding behind a camera, you can sort of, I think, interact with people better with a look-down viewfinder. Plus, too, the square format is very unique, and it changes the whole way you compose and the way you shoot when you're shooting square.
Well, it's one of the things I don't like about digital cameras is there's no such thing as a waist-level viewer.
No.
I mean, that's just heartbreaking. Even shooting the medium format, I have to use a prism. I just find it bizarre.
So let's talk about personal projects. I mean, you're doing all this very cool editorial, portraits, and really cool advertising campaigns. Do you find that you need to do personal projects, and do you work on personal things? Or is everything personal and it's all the same?
Well, it's funny you phrase it like that, because initially, I would always view people who would say things like, I'm shooting a personal project, or this is my personal work. And I'd be like, well, really? You don't like what you shoot for work?
Right.
And I always find it perplexing because that's why I got into shooting celebrities. But what I've figured out for me over time is, even if it's involving celebrities, I can do very odd personal projects that obviously a magazine wouldn't use. So that's actually kind of fun. But also I'm doing projects that involve real people and family and things like this that are personal projects that aren't like commercial projects. And I kind of realized too that in a way it's a better way of communicating with my advertising clients and potential advertising clients because they're not likely to hire me to shoot celebrities. So I need to shoot real people, and the best way to shoot them is through personal projects.
What's your thoughts on a lot of people that are shooting, let's say we would call a personal projects, like to use things more rougher and gritty like a Holga or some plastic lens camera to get a really unique sort of off-the-wall look? Do you like doing alternate toy camera things or cross-process?
I'm a straight photography guy. I like the look of a lot of that work, but it's not for me. It really is not for me. I guess it's something early on in my career when I first moved to New York. I tried shooting a little Holga, and I was doing stuff where I was putting big fat borders on my pictures and sepia toning them and stuff. And I kind of realized that this is getting in the way of my development as a photographer. Putting a border on a picture or sepia toning it, it always looks pretty cool. So you can kind of shoot almost anything, and it looks cool. And I kind of realized I need to crop out those borders, just do straight black and white or color prints, and then make the picture interesting. And if I can do that, then I'm doing just fine. And I think for my discipline as a photographer, it was important for me to not rely on those. What I felt for me was tricks. Now, that said, I've seen work that I love that uses those approaches, Holga or borders or whatever, and that's fine, and I don't discount those photographers. But I realize for me, for my discipline, it's important for me to shoot as a straight photographer.
Yeah, and I think you'll find, like you said, these tricks a lot with people that are using digital, trying to emulate film and trying to find a unique look or do something different because the capture medium is just so blah.
Well, it does make everyone's work look the same. Another thing about film, I think, too, that we haven't discussed yet, and you guys might talk about it on your site, but I think that people who shoot film or projects that are shot on film are perceived and will continue to be perceived as being more artistic, and things shot on digital will be perceived as being more commercial. I think if you want to have any kind of gallery career, especially long-term, I think it would behoove you to shoot film.
Well, definitely, and you speak to gallery owners now, and you show them a body of work, and you say, this was on film. And they're like, really? Film? And they're more interested in talking to you and looking at your book compared to, oh, it was digital. Cool. And if you especially look at the sector of wedding and portrait, people are touting film as fine art. And they're shooting a stop or a stop and a half overexposed on color neg and getting creamy, beautiful pastel stuff that it's hard for these guys to emulate in digital with all these cool plugins and all the great stuff. You just can't hit it.
I tell you, when I got married 5 years ago, digital was already, especially among wedding photographers, was already paramount. And I asked for film. And this guy doesn't even shoot film now. He shoots only digital. But I asked for film. And of course, I asked for negatives too, which is awesome. So yeah, like our entire wedding, we did some snapshots shot in digital, but our wedding photographer shot all film. And boy, does it look great for it.
It is cool. And see, the thing is, you had the negative. So 5, 10, 15 years later, you can scan it on some newer super wazoo technology. And you're going to be able to even pull out more detail and have a beautiful image. And what if he had given you digital files 5 years ago? The stuff now, you'd be like, oh, look, what do I do with this?
Well, yeah, and you can already see the limitations, absolutely.
Sure, and file formats change, and what if you can't read it on the floppy disk anymore? Or think if you shot digital in the very beginnings, and now you can't even open those formats. I mean, what do you do?
Well, the funny thing is, I shoot digital on vacation now. So for snapshots like around the house or going to a party, I'll bring my snapshot digital camera. But if we go on vacation for like a week or two, I bring my film snapshot camera and I shoot film. And it makes a difference. It looks great, and I just feel like these memories are important. I want them to be on film.
This is very true. I have a little Olympus stylus, little Epic. It's like a little pocket point and shoot deal. You put film in it, but guess what? It's part of the same allure. You're on vacation, you're out just taking little snapshots, but it's something to look forward to when you get back. You get the film back, or you get the chrome back, and you get to look at it. It's like a gift every time you get stuff back from the lab and it's something cool. I think when you're shooting digital, I mean, it's handy, and yes, I like what I can take because I have a little camera in my iPhone, but nevertheless, it's great to have something always with you. Do you always go everywhere with a camera?
I do not, actually. It's not really my style. I guess because my background is in portraiture and real portrait sittings, I get a phone call and I go, I make the portrait. On vacation, of course, I make those kind of pictures because that's a vacation, but going on vacation as a photographer is a bit of a busman's holiday. I literally don't shoot any pictures for the first 3 or 4 days of vacation. My wife has to do them because I'm on vacation. I don't want to take pictures. And then only partway through, I'm like, well, I guess we should get some photos of this.
Well, it's sort of like looking at a mechanic. Typically, their cars are always broken, right? You don't want to work on your own stuff. So if you're a photographer and you go on vacation, I mean, maybe you want to take pictures, but most likely you don't want to see a camera.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Chris, what do you look forward to in the future? You're doing more and more advertising work for some great clients. But what do you really look forward to as a photographer moving forward?
That's a good question. I really am enjoying doing my personal projects. I think that's pushing me into making a connection with some galleries so that I can have somewhere to show it in that context. I also would like to do books. I'm actually shooting a book project right now in which I'm looking for a publisher. My personal projects, they kind of start off as being like, oh, I'll do a promotional piece and it'll go on my website. And then 25 pictures later, I'm like, you know what? I could keep going on this. And I kind of think maybe this could be a book one day. So books, gallery shows, certainly continuing shooting the celebrities. When I started my career, I said to myself, I want to do this for 40 years. And I've been doing it for 20, and it's going fine, and I really want to keep doing it. I really admired people like Arnold Newman, who shot people of interest for a long, long, long time. He did his great artist series, and he'd shoot an artist in 1941 and then shoot them again in 1981. And it'd be kind of amazing to see those photographs next to each other. And I kind of looked at that and thought, well, it's going to take me a while to get there, but I'd like to do stuff like that.
Now, this is great work. So, Chris, tell me where people can find out about your website. You have the vintage site. Where can they look at your work, see what you're up to, and just check out all this beautiful photography?
Well, of course, my commercial site is chrisbuck.com. Basically, I made a new website about a year ago. My old website just shows just huge collections of work, but it's mostly individual commissions, and I want to show works as bodies of work. My new website collects the work a little better. The old website just has more pictures on it, and it is vintagechrisbuck.com. You also see a lot of work that's not on my website, on my agent's website. And they are March Casey and Associates. I think that's marchcasey.com. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how communicative people are, but I'm always happy to hear from people. And if people want to drop by and see me at my New York office, I'm always welcoming people to come by and show me their work and give any feedback or just chat or have a coffee or whatever. I'm very welcoming and accessible, so anyone who wants to contact me, I'm here.
No, this is great stuff, and I do appreciate you joining us today. We look forward to having you back on the program to talk about more of these great topics. And just very cool to have you today, and beautiful photography and cool work. I really appreciate it, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Well, there you go, Chris Buck. Great photographer, cool guy, beautiful work. Definitely check out his website. Stunning photography and, of course, great use of film and analog products. Very, very cool stuff going on with Chris. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.